So tonight I'm going to complete this series of four talks I've been giving on the four Brahma Viharas by looking at equanimity in Pali, Upekkha. First of all, I just want to say that equanimity is, in a sense, the thing that balances the other three, keeps things in balance. And I'll talk some more about that as we go along. But I want to start just by reading a little bit from Sharon Salzberg, when she's talking about that topic. Equanimity is taught as the final meditation among the Brahma Viharas because it provides the balance for loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. These others open one's heart in a wish of for well-being. May you be happy, may you be free from suffering, may your joy never cease. Equanimity balances these heartfelt wishes with the recognition that things are the way they are. However much we may wish for something, most results are beyond our control. So it's like, oh, a little dose of reality gets added into the whole process. And I think it's important to remember that, that in this sense, equanimity is that balancing energy. So it's like, in some senses, the culmination of the practice, not only in the Brahma Viharas, by the way. There's something called the seven factors of awakening is another. It's a major teaching of the Buddha, and the last of those seven is, oh, what a surprise, equanimity. And there's another list of 10, and the last one on that list is equanimity. So we keep coming back to this idea of equanimity, this stillness, this calmness, as being where this practice leads. And I want to actually start by this is a quote from Sharon Salzberg, just a one-line quote, where she defines equanimity, which I love this definition. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows it to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. I really like this for several reasons. The first one is the phrase spacious stillness. When you're in a state of equanimity, your mind is still, but spacious. There's room for everything. There's room for anything that arises. Nothing gets rejected. I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here as well. He's talking about this. Equanimity is, and this is from his, actually a chapter from his book Mindfulness called Equanimity. So I'm coming back to this chapter a few more times. Equanimity is one of these beautiful universals, is the mental factor called neutrality of mind. Another good definition, neutrality of mind. If your mind isn't neutral, you're grasping for things and trying to push things away all the time. Bhikkhu Bodhi said the Pali term could literally be translated as there in the middleness. Although this is an awkward construction in English, it does convey the balancing power of equanimity. Its characteristic is evenness. And when it is highly developed, it manifests as unshakable balance of mind. It serves to prevent either deficiency or excess in the other mental factors, including the Brahma Viharas. It serves to prevent either deficiency or excess. As in, it's one of thinking of excess. When I talked last week about mudita, sympathetic joy, if we're not careful, sympathetic joy can fall over into like wild giddiness. There's no balance, there's no evenness anymore. We've lost connection with ground and we're off in some wild place. And it sounds like, oh, that sounds like a lot of fun, but actually, from a meditative point of view, we need to sort of try and keep grounded. So that's what Joseph is talking about here. And he goes on. The first way to experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Oh man, this affects our daily life. Each of us is touched by what we call the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are the endlessly changing conditions of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. When equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our lives. Have you ever crashed into the changing circumstances of your life more than once? I just had to cancel a trip. I was supposed to go on a trip tomorrow and to see my son and daughter-in-law, and they're sick. So we had to cancel everything. Just like I was just before this, I got here, I was going canceling hotels and canceling flights, and there it is, the changing circumstances of our lives. It's okay. It's just so we'll see them some other time. It's not like the end of the world. It's just like, oh my God, this is what happens. Anyhow, I'll come back to that list of what he called the eight vicissitudes. We'll talk about that more later. I want to continue talking about this definition, however. And I want, this is another, yet another definition. There's lots of definitions of equanimity. Another definition of equanimity, this one by Rebecca Bradshaw, emphasizes this aspect of mind and its benefits. So this aspect of nothing being rejected. Equanimity is the continuous accommodation of the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart mind can connect with this world and all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. So it's not like we're standing in the river of change trying to block it. We're trying to learn how to flow with the river of change, which, by the way, includes us. We're part of the river of change. And we're just trying to flow along with everything else that's happening all around us in this flow of this river of change. Another aspect of Sharon's definition is also significant. It's the phrase radiant calm. So not only is, when you're in equanimity, not only is your mind focused and still, but you literally become a source of this wholesome mind state for others around you. You are a radiator of calmness. Boy, does the world ever need that, huh? And it's like, this is one of the beauties of this practice, is we get to these places where simply by being who we are. And this sounds kind of almost conceited, but it isn't. This is my experience. Just by being who you are, you're this radiant calm, and people feel it. People come to our house, because my wife practices in a different tradition, but she practices and chants a lot. And they come to our house and say, "Boy, it's really different here in your house, isn't it?" And I just go, "Yeah, it's like we're pretty calm here." It's a different vibe than people experience. Excuse me. And it's just this radiant calm is, it's not always there, and sometimes it's totally crazy too here, just like everyone else. But we tend towards the radiant calm, right? Many, and here's another thought. Many people think that practice of meditation is selfish. Have you heard this one? Where it's like, oh, you're just sort of doing things to make yourself wonderful and holy, and you're just sitting around when you should be doing something useful. But what could be more useful? What could be more useful than being a radiator of calm? and stillness. I mean, what could be more useful than that? Really? Finally, in Sharon's definition, there's one more phrase here I want to point out. To be fully present with all the different changing experiences. Fully present with all the different changing experiences. In other words, we don't grab on and get lost in some. We don't try and push some away. We don't try and ignore them. We're fully present with all the different changing experiences. This could be a really good definition of not suffering, of not being in the midst of dukkha all the time. Because what happens is we suffer because we cling to things that arise or we try and push them away, neither of which work in the end. They might give a little temporary release, but in the end they don't work. And in this process of either grabbing onto and trying to hold them and make them permanent, or pushing them away and hoping they won't ever come back, we're creating our own suffering and the suffering of others around us. When you do that, you don't flow with the river of change. You're not going with things as they are. You're trying to make them be a certain way. And that's just like not accepting reality, not accepting that everything is impermanent, constantly changing. It's a state where you don't get caught trying to make things be a certain way. Not even in your wildest dreams do you wish to make it a certain way. It's just be calm in the midst of what is. Now I want to point out something. There is another mind state that is externally. I mean, if you see someone who's equanimous, they're pretty sort of calm and still, right? There's another mind state called indifference. And indifference is, indifference in some texts you'll see, epeka or upeksham in Sanskrit, translated as indifference. But equanimity isn't indifferent at all. It looks the same, right? Outwardly, so if someone's indifferent, they're like, I don't care. It's pretty easy to be calm if you don't care. Much easier to be calm if you don't care. Just like, it's let everything slide, everything goes by, I'm cool. I'm cool, man, it's okay, But indifference is a rejection of the world. It's a strong sense of, I don't care. It isn't spacious at all. In fact, it's quite narrow. So it doesn't, accommodate the present moment, to go back to the quotes. It ignores it. Equanimity is infused with loving kindness. It's a sense of caring for all beings, but at the same time, understanding, as we said, the limits of what we are capable of and what we can manage to do or not do. So here now I want to go back to list where Joseph went through these. They call them. I love, first of all, I love the word vicissitudes. It's like, I love saying it just because it's such a great word, right? You ever heard of how's your vicissitudes today? And this is the endlessly changing conditions of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. So these are pairs of opposites, four pairs of opposites, and they're often talked about in that way. So first one is gain and loss. And we often think of this like in financial, I gain money, I lost money, or might also be like I gained fame, whatever. I got something or I lost something, right? But this is very common actually in the meditation practice world. How many times do we get caught thinking, especially on a longer retreat, this is very common, but even like in our just our daily practice. Oh, that was a good sit. And we think, oh, this is and part of our mind when we think that was a good sit, is our mind is going, ah, I finally got it figured out. This is how it's going to be from now on, right? It's going to be I finally figured out how to have a good sit. And maybe for a day or a week or a month, you have good sits every day. But sooner or later, the train wreck sit is bound to come. And there's nothing, and then it's like you had a bad sit. And it's like you really feel the loss. I gained something and then I lost it. And we try and figure out what we did wrong. Even, oh my God, how come I had such a terrible, bad sit? There's no such thing as good sits and bad sits. There's sits that are calmer or not so calm. But even the not so calm sits sometimes is where you really learn things, as you're dealing with all the junk that's in your mind. And if you're being sitting with it and sitting there in the midst of chaos, but you're aware that it's chaos, if you're mindful of the chaos, that's just as good as being mindful of some sweet, high energy thing that's happening. But we judge our sits based on whatever criteria you tend to use as good sits and bad sits. They're just sits. That's all. And when we can sort of get past the looking for a good sit and hoping we can have a good sit again, or looking for a bad sit, looking not to have a bad sit, trying to, oh, I remember last time I had a bad sit, I did that, so I'm not going to ever do that again. And we get into this weird place of trying to prevent a bad sit instead of, which means we're not paying attention to the present moment at all, because we're trying to manipulate the present moment to be the way it's supposed to be, because that's when I have a good sit. That's what it's like. Just a recipe for suffering. And this is small potato suffering compared to people losing their house in a tornado, sort of gain and loss. But this is what goes on all the time in our lives. We get stuff and then we lose it. Something happens and then something else happens and it goes away. It's just the nature. I've actually been dealing with gain and loss a lot the last couple of weeks. I've been trying to find a place to do day-long retreats in the winter, so it'll be inside. And man, I've talked to like 10 different places at this point, and I keep thinking, ah, I finally found one. And then, oh, by the way, we changed, we can't do that with you because you're not an official nonprofit. And it's like one thing after another. It's like, oh yeah, we can do that. This was a church just 2 days ago. All said it was going to be great. It's a nice church. It's a really nice hall. I know what the hall's like. It's great, but we can't guarantee that if we have to have something like a wedding or a funeral, we'll have to cancel your retreat. Well, yeah, kind of hard to operate under those conditions. Oh, then there's the place that's going to give me a discount on their regular rate and only charge $800 for the day. It's like, what? It's like, and it's like I, because I once again, oh boy, because they were really interested and they wanted to talk. He's going to go talk to the bosses and see if he can get a discount, because he knows their regular rate will probably be too high. And he comes, I got you a really good discount, only $800. But this is like, so my mind's been going through this gain and loss. Actually, I think I've actually found a place. I have to go check it out, but it sounds like it might actually work. So, more on that later. I'm in the gain mode at the moment. I finally, but I'm prepared, totally prepared for yet another thing to fall through. But it's, who knows? This looks pretty good. Anyhow, so that's gain and loss. And it's just how, what are we go through in our minds all the time. Then there's praise and blame. It's really easy to get caught up in feeling good about praise and feeling bad about blame. Letting other people tell you how good or bad you are. It's all just on other people's minds. Is this their reaction to whatever you are, or whatever you, however you present yourself at that, in that moment? And we create this drama about it. Both, oh, all this praise I'm getting, I must be a really great Dharma teacher, or a really great whatever, you know, really great painter, or really great gardener, or who knows, I'm just getting the ones I get. You get your different versions, I'm sure. Or you're not, you know, and it's like, you never know. It's like, it just comes and goes. And to get caught up in either of these, just either of these is a really powerful way to create a sense of self. When we start identifying with praise and blame, then I identify with the, I'm a good guy or I'm a bad guy. But there's the I in there that creates this sense of a separate self. Just by tuning into and taking it. And I'm not saying, you know, you shouldn't enjoy a little praise now and then and feel good about yourself. And I'm not saying you should, you know, not listen to when someone says something that sounds a little bit like blame, because maybe they have a point. But to get sort of, don't identify with it and invest in it. Don't, you know, take it so deeply to heart that you are still mulling it over 3 days from now. You know, people say things, it's okay, take it in and then let it be. Ah. So that's praise and blame. Then we have fame and disrepute. This is my notes say here. Praise and blame writ large. Because fame and disrepute really only ever exist in other people's minds. It has nothing to do with you at all. It's just opinions of other people. And we always talk about, you know, beware of views and opinions. Well, now we have to beware of other people's views and opinions as well. You know, fame and disrepute. And how many times you see someone who's, quote, famous, and then all of a sudden they're in disrepute. Just like that. Happens every, you know, every half the things you read in the newspaper about people being famous and then falling into disrepute. It's like, you know, and there's that joke, well, I want my 15 minutes of fame. Yeah, and then what do you get afterwards? You get 15 minutes of disrepute, guaranteed. It's like, you know, if you build yourself up to be something really important, you're bound to sort of, you know, get knocked down at some point. Fame and disrepute are guaranteed to be a pair. And you're going to get some of both. If you seek one, you're going to get the other. Ah, finally, pleasure and pain. This is about the fact that changes are inevitable. We get some pleasure, and then we get some pain. That's just the nature of life. It isn't like we deserve pleasure and we don't deserve pain, which people believe, or you know, you get what you deserve, even. It's just, that's the cycle of life. We're in this river of change. And the river of change has great, really pleasurable stuff and has stuff that is not so nice. And if we think somehow that it's our fault or our goodness that gets the pleasure and our fault that gets the pain, here we are creating more self, just like that. Here we are creating a bigger sense. I'm the person who deserved that good stuff. I'm the person who also deserved that bad stuff because I was bad. It's just we get caught up in this cycle of believing that we have much control at all over any of this. It's just stuff happens. And all we can do is just be aware that this is the perfectly natural that we go through these cycles of, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And none of it's our fault. It's just the way things are. And it's hard to take that in because we somehow think it, well, it's got to be somebody's fault. I want to, it's got to work. It's got to be that way somehow. And it's not. It's just how things are. Okay, so that's the eight vicissitudes. That's in daily life. That's the things we just, we can either, surf along the river of change. We can surf the river of change and sort of glide over these things and glide with them and go with them and be okay. This is what I got today. That's okay. Or we can try and swim against the current, and we all know what happens when you swim against the current. You get swept downstream and bump into the rocks, probably. So, anyhow, what about equanimity as a practice? Because it's like all the Brahma Viharas, there's actually a formal practice method that goes along with them. And for equanimity, there's this really interesting phrase that is taught as the, like the other things, you have a phrase you're repeating and you're thinking of a particular person. And you start with yourself. And this is the phrase. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. So if I was going me, I am the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes. Our actions are what creates suffering or happiness. That's putting it right down on the very bottom line. It's how we act, and in particular, how we react to what's arising in this constant flow. And but we think somehow I can sort of wish myself into happiness. If I just figure it out, I can be happy if I just wish myself into happiness somehow. So I'll create this positive mental vibe, and I'll glow, and it'll be wonderful. And it doesn't work because we are the owner of our karma. We have to deal with the results of our past actions as well. And this is okay. I can sort of take this in for myself, but now switch this around and think, now you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And think about someone who's really dear to you, your spouse, one of your children, your partner, your dog, could be anything, right? And you think, when you think of them, think that they're the owner of their karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends on their actions, not on your wishes for them. What this is saying, and this is really, I think, quite profound, is you can't make someone happy. As much as we want to, as much as we'll try to make someone happy, we can't ever make someone happy. Because they're the owners of their own karma. Their actions are what create their happiness, not our wishes for them. And I'm not saying for one second that you can't do things that are quite wonderful and that might help create causes and conditions such that someone else might be happy. But for them to actually be happy, it's totally up to them. This is really hard to take in when we think of those people close to us. Because we think somehow I want to make that person happy, especially if they're sort of in, with that sort of having one of their glum days. I thought, oh, I should make them happy. It's like my responsibility to make them happy. No, it's not. It's my responsibility to maybe do something nice or sweet or kind that might create causes and conditions that might create happiness in them. But how they respond is totally up to them, not up to you. You just have no control at all. However, whatever you're going to do, how they're going to respond to that is their stuff. And when we think of people dear to us, we don't want to think this even, let alone take it in. How can I not make them happy? This is really common in parents. Like, someone, I'm supposed to make my kids happy. It's my job, right? But you can't. And it's also true of, like, I've seen the flip side of this. Children whose parents are getting elderly and somehow they need your help a little bit. Now it's my job to make them happy. Well, no, you can make them comfortable. You can help them get along and deal with the stuff that comes with being older. But you can't make them happy. They can make themselves happy. That's all. And this is a serious thing we have to sort of take in. And it's one of the primary teachings of equanimity. This phrase, just when I first heard this phrase, it's sort of like, wow. But it's like, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And I want to repeat, I'm not saying you shouldn't do nice things for people that might make them happy, but whether or not it actually makes them happy is totally beyond your control. And you shouldn't. What happens is we do something to make someone happy, and then they don't get happy, and then we get mad. I just did all this great stuff for you, and you're still not happy. What's wrong with you? We feel we become invested. We want results. Another road to suffering, if there ever was one. Absolutely a huge road to suffering. Wanting, doing something because we think it's going to make someone happy, and then they don't get happy, and then we blame them for our suffering. Is because our suffering is, oh, I did all this stuff and they didn't respond the way they should. How often do we get caught in that one? This is just how it is. And it also, when you think of this about ourselves, it's like acknowledging that all of it, all our happiness is up to us. That we it's up to us to sort of work. Practice diligently the doing things that lead toward happiness. That's up all on us. And even then, this is the tricky part. We can do everything we want to think that's going to make us happy, and it might not make us happy anyway, and then we have to be okay with that. We can't, oh, well, that didn't work, so why bother with me doing all this stuff? Well, who knows? Over years, over time, who knows? Anyhow, I'm sort of wandering a little bit here, but I think it's really important that we take this in our daily lives and also in our practice. We think we want our practice to make us happy. No, our practice is just our practice. And sometimes it makes us happy, and sometimes, we have long periods of practice where it's like just all this junk comes up and it's just miserable. And sometimes that's what practice is going to be. Practice, I guarantee you're going to be practicing and be totally miserable the whole time you're practicing. But this is when probably you're going to learn more. It's like, oh my God, I can be miserable and be okay with being miserable. That's a huge learning. When we see that, we can be mindful and not ha and be unhappy at the same time. It's really a powerful thing to see and to feel. So once the mind is equanimous, and this is now talking about what's the effect of this, the primary thing from reading various places, and I'll read something from Joseph in a little bit, but it's basically we start to see through our practice what are called the three characteristics. That everything's impermanent, arising and passing away. That it's everything's unreliable, it's unsatisfactory because it's always changing, and that there's no in this flow of river of change, there's no solid permanent self there that can be found. And when we're equanimous, which means the mind is still and calm and focused, this is the time in practice and formal sitting practice or walking practice where we start to experience these three characteristics, as opposed to them being sort of interesting philosophical statements. They're like what we actually experience. So we start to see the river of change just flowing by. We're not caught up so much in paying attention to the content of what's arising, as just the pattern, the underlying pattern of what's arising, because that's the underlying pattern. Everything's changing all the time. Nothing's reliable. And there's no self there at all. That's what actually we start to see. That's what the practice leads us to. This is what Joseph calls the wisdom aspect of equanimity. This wisdom aspect of equanimity is beautifully expressed in the famous opening lines of On the Faith Mind by the third Zen ancestor. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When attachment and aversion are both absent, the way is clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are infinitely apart. I love the way is clear and undisguised. It's like the way is often disguised. We don't see it because we're so caught up in seeing the differences. Practicing the great way, the equanimity of non-preferential awareness, supports the development of all the awakening factors, these are the seven factors of awakening. As it becomes strong, we gain deeper, ever deeper insights into the three characteristics. We know the truth of change, not only as a conceptual understanding, but also in the direct experience of things arising and passing away. Sometimes this experience of impermanence is on a macro level, and then increasingly on a momentary micro level. At this point, our meditation is less involved in what it is that is arising than with the process of change itself. We experience the truth of dukkha, the unreliability and unsatisfying nature of conditioned phenomena. Stuff, this happens. We see the continual dissolution of everything that arises, and at times even the momentary dissolution of consciousness itself. And we experience the truth of selflessness when we see nothing lasts long enough to be called self. It's an interesting statement, huh? And we experience the truth of selflessness when we see nothing lasts long enough to be called self. All phenomena arise out of our appropriate causes and conditions, unsubstantial, empty of any inherent self-existence. Phenomena are like rainbows, colored lights arising out of momentary changing conditions, both vivid and insubstantial at the same time. How often do we have vivid thoughts and ideas and things, and we don't, well, we don't see the insubstantialness of them? It's like we have to see both. We have to both see the colors of the rainbow and also understand that it's just some light refracting in some water vapor in the air. That's all it is. It's nothing. There's no solidity to it at all. And we can sort of see that in rainbows because we sort of understand the physics of it, right? We don't see it too often in ourselves. And it's equally true of that sense of self that we keep building on up. So, actually, I have a, this is such a good topic. I have two bits of poetry tonight. This first one is from Dana Falls, from her book Going and In. And it's called Remember This. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. It's a really positive thought, a wholesome thought to have. And then this is from Mary Oliver. Book Evidence, and just the last section of a longer poem that I keep coming back to because it says everything I want to talk about. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I have become the child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this? Which is all I know? Love yourself. Then forget it. Then love the world. Great advice. So the last thing I want to mention, and I sort of alluded to this at the beginning of the talk, is that these four Brahmaviharas I've been talking about, you know, metta and karuna and mudita, and upekkha, you know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and this equanimity. And we talk of them as four separate things, but they're so interwoven and so connected to each other that they, you know, like I said earlier, about upekkha being the thing that balances everything, right? And how earlier on I talked about how loving kindness, a heart full of loving kindness that encounters suffering, compassion naturally arises. You know, so they're all fit together in this really beautiful way that keeps do you folks know what a tetrahedron is? You know, so it's a solid that's made up of four triangles. So think of a pyramid with three sides. And then the bottom is the fourth side. So it's all four sides. And you can think of these four Brahma Viharas is the four sides of the tetrahedron. Well, they're all, but there's only one object. There just has to happen to have four. Oh, I can look at it this way, and I see this one, and look over here, I see this one. But it's all the same thing. They're so interrelated to each other, and they support each other, and they grow with each other. It's not like, well, I'll just have metta and forget about those other things, or whatever. We have to sort of see this as a whole collection that's really one thing, intimately bound together and supporting each other and working together, because that's what they are. They're four wholesome mind states that the Buddha talked about all the time. Some traditions call these the four immeasurables, and I love that word as well. You'll see that in the sutta. They called talked about the Buddha talks about these as being immeasurable. There's never a limit to any of these. There's never like, oh well, that's all a metta I can do. No, I'm sorry, there's more there. There's always more there. There's always more there. And when we start to see that, now we're getting someplace. And these are all just practices, right? I mean, that's the other thing. These are all practices. Working with these mental formations, these mind states, are just practices. We can practice trying to be more mindful about how we react to others. And that, there it is, everything right there. If we're just more mindful of how we react to others, then we're going to have more metta, we're going to have more compassion, we're going to have more mudita, and we're going to balance it all with upekkha, because the upekkha is the mindful balancing of them all. So not only are they related to each other, they're very directly connected and related to mindfulness as well. Without mindfulness, none of them would work. We couldn't do any of this without mindfulness. It's just, oh, I can look over here from this direction, look over here from that direction. That's all we're trying to do.